teachers presentations session. So these are very short talk. I would like you guys to give just a glimpse of your research so that, you know, there is some possibility to discuss it later on. Okay, so I will chair the session. You will have the co-host privilege, so you can share your screen whenever you're ready. So Karen, you're starting, so maybe you should share your screen. Okay, this is working. So I'm going to be very strict with time. So are you ready, Karen?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Ready, steady, go.
Okay. I'm going to talk about something that the foundations of it are a little bit old now, but that I feel like maybe more people should do cool stuff with. And I'm going to talk about some chord diagram expansions. So these are chord diagram expansions. And what do I mean by a chord diagram? You can think of it, I'm always going to work with rooted chord diagrams. So I mean something like this, say, I don't know, something like that. You could also think of it in a linear form. So you could go something like this. Let's try to draw the same one. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that I mean by a chord diagram. And now the point is that in many cases, when you have Dyson-Schwinger equations, you can solve them in terms of a chord diagram expansion. All right, and so that's the C here. And I'm not gonna define all the terms in 6 minutes, but the point is you have these expansions. I've only drawn you out the simplest case, which is some work with a PhD student from quite a while ago. And what do you get? Well, each chord diagram contributes just a fairly small polynomial. And there's a coefficient here that comes from some parts of the chord diagram. It comes from what we call terminal chords. So just to make this example a little more exciting, if I put another guy there like that, then in this example, the terminal chords end up being this one and this one and this one. So the terminal chords are the ones where it's okay, there could be stuff like this coming into the chord that way, but you're not allowed to have anything coming out the other way. So that's what makes you a terminal chord. And so you sum over those things, these T's are the indices of the terminal chords, there's lots of details, but you get these expansions and you get these expansions in a variety of different circumstances. I would note that these are not from Wick's theorem, even though you're seeing chord diagrams and your first thought is probably Wick's theorem. And the first examples were just in the Yukawa theory, but you can apply this to a lot of different theories. Some of the differences are showing up in the Fs, and some of them are showing up more in the combinatorics. And so while factorial growth in the number of things you're summing over remains, each chord diagram is contributing something quite simple. And so that's one of the ways that I think this is a very useful expansion. Okay, well, how can it be useful? So I think these things are both useful mathematically and physically. And so here are some examples of how that's the case. One is this approach is particularly well suited to answering asymptotic questions about perturbative expansions, especially when you're thinking about some leading log, next to leading log, next to next to leading log expansions, because those just end up being generating series for the chord diagrams with a particular condition on the terminal chords that is fairly computable. Basically, these terminal chords have to be shoved fairly far to the end. And so here, again, without telling you what all the notation means, here are some examples of some of the results that we can get. So this is a kth leading log expansion in a particular context. And you say, well, what is the asymptotic behavior of the nth coefficient of that? This is the algebraic combinatorics notation for the coefficient of in that series. And what do you get? Well, you get actually a dichotomy. You get two different cases. I guess there should really be one of these things here. And this S parameter is basically telling you when you're inserting in the original Feynman diagram situation, when you're inserting the diagrams into each other, it's saying as the loop order grows, how many new insertion places do you get? And if the answer is two or more, then you're in this top situation. If the answer is just one new insertion place at each loop order, then what you get is this. And so, well, first of all, you can, as a message, you get these fairly concrete expressions. And the second message is you get this interesting dichotomy between these two different insertion patterns. On the pure combinatoric side, I think one of the interests of this has been, in some sense, it's been rejuvenating that pure combinatorics of chord diagrams. And I know Julien and Noam and other people like that have been thinking about chord diagrams and some of their just pure enumerative properties. And finally, I think in terms of things that are looking a bit more to the future, I am hopeful that we can use some of these ideas to get some insight into combinatorics, not just of the perturbative expansion itself, but also of the instanton expansions. And so here's an example. So this would just be your normal perturbative expansion. And you see this is the sum of rooted connected chord diagrams, which is what we've been counting all along. So this is, again, this original example, like that very first one that I showed you. And if you go down, well, and then this would be your first instanton and second and so on, your instanton expansions. But if you think of putting this into a square shape and instead go down the columns, then this is counting labeled rooted trees. So there's, I think, a very interesting combinatorial question about what interpolates between the rooted chord diagrams and the labeled rooted trees, which I don't have an answer to right now, but maybe in another little while I will. And finally, we're still working on extending this to more examples. And I think it should be applicable to basically all physically interesting Dyson-Schwinger equations so that it really does give you an alternate kind of expansion that I find useful and I hope you will find useful. All right, I'm gonna quit there. And I think now you guys should listen to all these other people who are doing awesome things.
Okay, thanks for keeping in time. Any questions? I don't see anyone. You can raise your hand or you can post on the chat. Okay, so since there are no questions, I can ask a quick question. When you say all physically interesting Dyson-Schwinger equations, how far do you want to go with physically interesting? I mean, what sorts of theories you're talking about?
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, right now it's, there's a sort of single scale restriction. So we're really looking at propagator insertions, but that I think is tackleable, not next year, but in the next little while. And then it has a lot more to do with the shape than with the actual details of the physical theory. So I hope then it would actually really be useful for a lot of crazy Dyson-Schwinger equations, but you tell me what theory you want.
I want quantum gravity.
Oh yeah,
I think, yeah. I would just, for now, I would just do it with you know, standard model, Young-Mills.
I don't have a theorem that has it for all of standard model, but I am optimistic that that should be achievable with these techniques.
This is awesome. Okay, yeah, we should talk about it later. Thank you so much. Okay, so next on my list is Sabine. If you could share your screen. Hi. And yeah, the round of applause. okay. Yeah, are you ready to start?
Yes.
All right. So ready, steady, go.
Okay, so first I would like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to talk here today. So I'm a PhD student at École Polytechnique and Heidelberg University, and I will quickly present you my subject in my thesis about true normalization in tensor field theories and the Mellonic fixed point. So first of all, tensor field theories are interesting because random tensors have a large length and limits dominated by Mellon diagrams. And to show you why this is a nice feature, I will go from vector to tensor models. So first, the most straightforward large N theory you could think of would be with a vector model. And then the larger limits would be dominated by this type of diagrams called cactus or bubble diagrams. That's all quite easy to deal with, but that are not so much rich because you have only local insertions. Then you can go to matrix models. So now your field is a matrix, and the larger limit will be dominated by planar diagrams. So it's much more richer, but now it would be hard to manage and to do computation with it. And in between those, you have tensor models, so with at least three indices. And now the larger limit is dominated by these Mellon diagrams. So you have you construct them by recursively inserting this kind of two-point function onto the edge of a Mellon. And now you will have something that is more rich than the vector model because you now have these bilocal insertions, but it is also tractable. So that's what makes this kind of Largen theory interesting. But now what can we do in practice with it? So it was first introduced in zero dimension in the context of random geometry and quantum gravity. Then it was generalized in 1D in strongly coupled QFTs and holography, especially the SYK model without disorder. And I think you will have more detail on this in Adrian Tanaza's talk. And finally, it was generalized in higher dimensions to proper quantum field theories. So that's what I'm working on. And it has been shown that they give rise to a new class of conformal field theories. However, there are some divergences in the computation of the two and four-point functions and in the computation of the dimensions of the bilinears. So we studied rigorously the renormalization group of this model, we computed the beta function, and we proved the existence of some attractive fixed point. So I will just quickly present the model we studied. So the simplest model you can study in tensor field theory is the ON-cube bosonic model. So your field is a tensor of rank 3, and the indices are distinguished by the position, and we have quartic interactions. So we have three different quartic interactions that correspond to the ON-cube invariants, and we call them tetrahedron, pillow, double trace. Here, the vertices represent the tensors, and the edges represent the contraction of two indices, and the colors distinguish the position. Another feature of our model is this power here, zeta, in the Laplacian. That is a non-integral power between 0 and 1, and those type of models are called long range. And this allowed us to fix the dimension d smaller than 4, and to work in what we call the weakly relevant case, so zeta equals d plus epsilon over 4 at small epsilon. So this allows us to do a rigorous renormalization at, for example, d equals 3, which would not be possible in a standard dimensional renormalization like d equals 4 minus epsilon. And we also needed some higher regularization, and we chose a BPSJ substitution scheme at zero momentum. So I don't have much time to go into the details of what exactly is our renormalization scheme. So I will just present you the results we obtained. So we computed the beta function. And then for a three coupling, the first one, the tetrahedron, does not run. And the fixed point for the other two couplings are parametrized by this coupling, and we obtain four lines of fixed points. And if we choose the tetrahedral coupling to be purely imaginary, then one of them is infrared attractive and stable. And then we have an explicit renormalization group from trajectory, sorry, from the UV to the IR fixed point. So to conclude, I will just present some further work. So after that, we did some more detailed study of this type of CFT that we call Mellonic CFT. For example, we computed the dimensions of bilinears and the OPE coefficients. And for this, I invite you to see the poster session. We can also apply this to other types of tensor models. So with sextic interactions, for example, bipartite model, fermions, or other symmetry groups like SUN or SPN. And a very long-term question, but still interesting, would be what is the holographic dual of these CFTs and can it be computed? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. That was an actual gong in my house. Are there any questions? Questions? You can raise your hand or post on the chat. I don't see any questions. Let me ask a quick question then. So this last result you presented, the existence of that fixed point you showed on the last slide, was it surprising to find it? Or I mean, the results you got about the existence and behavior of the fixed points there, was it something you expected to happen, or were there any surprises along the way?
We expected to find a fixed point because before this kind of normalization had been done before in DIMREG with D equal 4 minus epsilon, but there they found unstable fixed points, and the fixed point was actually complex in the dimension of bilinears also. And what was interesting here is that now we have this free parameter, the T2LL coupling. And when choosing it to be purely imaginary, in fact, our fixed point was stable and real. So that was the surprise, but we were hoping to have a fixed point and we knew that this should be one.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. And just to reiterate, there is also a poster you guys can look at with more detail. Okay, thank you so much. Let's go to the next talk. So the next on my list is Feline. Here you are.
Okay, do you see my screen, I think?
Yes. Okay, yes. Perfect. Are you ready?
I am. Thank you.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, so I also want to start out by thanking the organizers for giving me this opportunity to give a talk and also to do a bit of promotion for the poster session at the end, where I will be available for any further discussion and where we have a bit more time than right now. So I'm a PhD student at DAISY in Hamburg. And I will be talking about conformal defects and emergent supersymmetry. And it's based on this work here with Pedro Liendo and Aleix Jiménez-Cao. And so let me first start with telling you what we did and then why we did it. So we studied three-dimensional conformal field theories with a low amount of supersymmetry, so n equals 2. And we included a boundary. And actually, there's two different possibilities for a boundary in these theories. And one of them can be extended to general dimensions. And we studied this using the defect bootstrap in the 4 minus epsilon expansion. And then at the end, we checked with perturbative calculations for a specific model, in our case, the Wessimino model. So I think conformal field theories don't need a why anymore because we have seen them today already and they're prevalent all over the place in theoretical physics. But we studied superconformal theories, and one of the reasons to add supersymmetry is that it gives you more control over your theory. So you have extra symmetries which can give you a nice relations between observables. Your operators can get protected dimensions, and all in all, it makes it easier to do certain computations. And one specific type of supersymmetry is the emergent supersymmetry. And there was also some talk about emergent symmetries in the discussion earlier. And this can arise at fixed points. So you can start out with a theory in the UV, for example, this one here, that is not supersymmetric. And also along the renormalization group flow, there is no supersymmetry. But once you reach a fixed point in the IR, instead of going to a conformal field theory, you can go to a superconformal field theory. And this is a very interesting way of thinking about supersymmetry. And it happens mostly, as you can see here, for rather low amounts of SUSY, so n equals 1 or n equals 2. So we studied a superconformal field theory with a boundary. And a boundary is an example of a conformal defect or an extended object. And you can see this as a generalization of your CFT. Well, we have seen them from a mathematical point of view from Katrin Meusberger's presentation. And in physics, we can find them from low energies in condensed matter to high energies, for example, Wilson lines in string theory. And what's interesting is that they break part of the conformal symmetry of your theory. And if they preserve a conformal subgroup, we talk about conformal defects. And in that sense, you start out with your bulk conformal field theory for the non-supersymmetric case, and then go to a conformal group on the defect where P is the dimension of the defect. And it also preserves rotations around the defect. In the case of a boundary, there are none, but for a line defect, for example, you preserve some rotations. And what's also interesting is that there is no conserved stress energy tensor on the defect. And instead, there appears a new type of operator called the displacement operator, which is related to the bulk stress energy tensor in the following way. And some defects can also preserve part of your original supersymmetry. So this is also what we studied. We studied half BPS boundaries, so they preserve half of the supersymmetry. So you start out with a supergroup and then break it into a smaller supergroup. And how this breaking is done exactly really depends on the theory and the defect you're studying. And what is interesting is that a defect can break the bulk supergroup in multiple ways. So we had two possible boundaries where one of them preserved some extra symmetry, for example, called R symmetry, and the other one did not. So you can study two completely different systems with one setup. So then we arrived at the how we studied these theories, and we used the defect bootstrap. So for those of you that are familiar with conformal bootstrap, it's very similar. And what you do is you look at certain correlators of bulk fields, and you can already start at the two-point bulk correlator that is not completely fixed, but depends on cross ratios. And there's two ways to look at them and to combine these operators. You can either bring them together and use the bulk OPE, expand them in local bulk operators, bring them to the defect, or expand them in defect operators and then bring them together. And this gives you crossing symmetry. And this is the final equation that we try to solve for all quantum numbers that you see here. So conformal dimensions and coefficients. And if you want to know more about how we did this and the technicalities, then please come to the poster session on Thursday afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much for the very nice talk. Are there any questions? Let's see. More questions? So just a short clarification question. So the way you're solving that equation, you showed at the end. So this is perturbative or non-perturbative? What kind of solutions you're finding there?
Yeah, so in principle, you would solve, like, one of the advantages of the bootstrap is that you can solve it non-perturbatively, but one of the disadvantages of the defect bootstrap is that you cannot use numerics because you don't have this conserved stress energy tensor. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find other ways, other limits, and we decided to do it perturbatively, so to go to general dimensions D and then to go back to 4 minus epsilon and then expand in powers of epsilon. And then the advantage is that you introduce so normally you have objects called conformal blocks and you get an infinite amount of them, but in this expansion you can do it step by step, And this gives you a lot more control and allows to actually solve part of the theory.
Okay, yeah, thanks. And thank you for the talk. And I encourage everyone to also look at Filin's poster. Okay, I think we should move to the next person. So Maria Elena.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You can share your screen now.
Okay. My presentation.
That looks good.
Should I do it in presentation or mode?
Maybe. Let's see. I see that there's a green window in the middle, at least for me. But let's see.
Maybe this is better.
That might work. Ah, okay. Now it's very good. Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready to start?
So how many minutes, sorry?
You have 6 minutes plus 2 minutes question. I will interrupt you after 6 minutes.
All right.
Okay, ready?
Thank you, yes.
Go.
Hi, well, this is my first time in this a really, really nice meeting. And I thank the organizers for letting me speak at this event. I'm interested in doing calculations within the regime of QCD, the realm of collisions of hadrons in colliders, and theoretically how we can get to build observables that are measurable at these experiments. And so I'm working mainly with QCD, and initially I was working using the tools of these gauge theories to predict the structure of the underlying observables, of the underlying structure for these observables. And one of the main tools that we use is basically a factorization theorem, which in other words relates the probability to produce particles at the detectors with a calculation that basically contains in a factorized manner all the short distance physics in one item and then the long distance physics in another item, this kind of universal function called a PDF or a fragmentation function. And then this idea that you can sort of separate these two regimes holds up until you make an approximation, which depends on the energy transfer at the core of this process. So in this area of work, we usually take advantage of this factorization theorem because you can sort of calculate things separately and then just put them together either by hand or in a computer in a simulation. And this factorization in QCD holds to in many experiments, and it has led to the universality of these functions that we use. We take from one experiment and we take them to another calculation. But what we found out a long time ago is that the factorization of these long distance and short distance dynamics in QCD actually holds at the more fundamental level, at the amplitude level. So what we found is that you can sort of do the same that you do at the level of the observables and build a factorized amplitude that separates the infrared finite structure of this QCD amplitude and separates the sort of the soft and radiation information in a kind of a soft function. And then you can plug in a function that collects all the hard information, the collinear singularities in this kind of jet function. In any case, this provided us with tools in vacuum, and in particular, you can connect the way that these soft, hard, and jet functions work with the anomalous dimension matrix, which collects the way that color connects in this space. It's summarized in this matrix. And in the jet function, you can collect information of the way that the partons radiate, which also give you an information of the infrared structure of the theory. But what happens when you want to describe processes in in heavy ion collisions, where you now produce these particles in a medium with temperature and high density. So what happens then is that you have, now you have the role of temperature and density in this game. And so that you have to start to make decisions about where do you use your gauge theories? What are the relevant scales for the deconfined phase and the confined phase, the hadron production? And how does factorization work in, now in this regime? This is the question that I want to work on, I'm working on. Especially since we already know from the literature that this kind of factorized amplitudes, the Feynman diagrams that you work on, actually don't have the same tools that you had before in vacuum. Now, depending on the observable, depending on the species that you're colliding, you may have temperature and density playing a role in sort of screwing up with this factorization picture. In fact, people nowadays are trying to use the factorization theorem in vacuum, just bringing it into the heavy high-end collision scene by factorizing the effect of the medium through some fits, global fits to this jet functions. But we have tools from the past. We have sort of hot gauge theories. We have a hard thermal loop expansion, sort of quantum corrections in the presence of temperature, and we can do kind of like a factorization between hard momenta and soft momenta physics, or strong dynamics and soft dynamics physics. And we can take into account the fact that this program of hard thermal loop can be extended to include some other kinds of approximations in the context of amplitudes in medium factorization. Especially in the literature today, you can find ideas where these hard thermal loop amplitudes, the amplitudes that you would need in this factorized proposal, now can be connected to limits of off-shell amplitudes, classical limits of off-shell amplitudes that were built at in vacuum at T equals zero. You can actually connect to this thermal loop amplitudes. Also, you can take into account the distinction that you can make between describing the scattering amplitudes using the momentum of the particle versus its wave numbers. And this allows you to, again, separate soft and hard thermal currents. And finally, there's certain ideas that have flourished in the past 10 years where you have this duality between tree amplitudes and loop amplitudes. And in fact, the work done by many, many people in the literature back from 2010 to these days allows us to imagine a possibility where you can use formalisms like the Schwinger-Kailish formalism to create these amplitudes, these tree amplitudes that actually contain a factorized structure for that is useful in this context. So thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for a nice talk and nice graphics as well. Are there any questions? Questions? So what's the next big step to be taken in sort of understanding what's going on with the quark gluon plasma? So what are big open questions there that one tries to address?
Well, basically, from the theoretical point of view, you have many. Like perturbative approaches to calculating observables that consider temperature to be the highest scale. So you can imagine saying, okay, temperature will be my relevant scale, my hard scale. So you are having lots of tools to do perturbative calculations, let's say along the vertical axis in this phase diagram of QCD matter. But actually what happens is that you're looking for critical signatures, signatures where you have phase transitions between the quark gluon plasma and the hadron phase. And in order to reach these critical observables, you need to use tools that actually are not in the realm where temperature is the dominant scale. Now you have to take into account the pressure or the density of matter. And you have to, so this is why my question earlier today was how relevant, how can we have like entropy playing a role rather than temperature, temperature corrections to the observables instead of pursuing this kind of traditional approach? Why don't we choose entropy as a way to explore now these regions here? So this is the part that I'm working on right now. But of course, there's many, many opportunities, for especially for people that work in duality, since these phases of the matter contain many, many dual connections. So.
Nice. Okay. Thank you very much. It definitely looks very interesting. Okay, so the next person that would be Mariam. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Then ready, steady, go.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank the organizers for letting me give a talk here. I'm a PhD student at Emory University in math. So this is going to be a slightly more mathematical than physics-y. So the title of my talk is Elliptic Curves in Thompson's Group. And the main idea of my talk is the following. I want to ask, can moonshine help answer number theoretic questions? And here's a number theoretic question that I care about. The answer is yes, spoiler alert, otherwise I wouldn't be asking this question. So here's a number theoretic question that I care about. So let E be an elliptic curve defined over Q, and let EQ denote the set of Q rational points on E. Then it is well known, it was proven by Mordell in 1920s, that EQ has a structure of a finitely generated abelian group on it. So what that means is that there is a finite part, so the torsion part, and there's an infinite part, which is just R copies of the set of integers, where R is some non-negative number. R is called the rank of the elliptic curve, and computing the rank of a general elliptic curve is considered a hard problem in number theory. Okay, it is, if this is your first time hearing about this problem, then something to keep in mind is that it is hard enough that if you solve it, you would get $1 million. It's one of the Millennium Prize problems. So the Bergson-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, which is actually the conjecture that if you solve, you would get $1 million. The weak version of that conjecture says that the rank of an elliptic curve equals the order of vanishing of its L function at S equals one. Okay. Okay, so the general problem is hard to solve, but can we say things about particular elliptic curves? And can we solve a more particular problem is the idea of this talk. So let's focus on one elliptic curve. Here's an elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus 864x minus 432. And for D, a negative fundamental discriminant, I'm going to define ED to be the quadratic twist, which is defined this way. If you define a quadratic twist this way, then it gives you the same elliptic curve as E over the complex numbers, but not over Q. So over Q, these are different elliptic curves. So basically what I've done is I've given you a parameter, which if you change D, you get a family of elliptic curves that are all related to E in some natural way. And I can now ask what happens to the rank in this family. As I vary D, what happens to the rank of E of D? Okay, anytime you run into a problem like this, something to try might be to try to collect some data. So here's some data for you. So I'm going to restrict your discriminants such that D is not a square mod 19. And then here's a table that I've just written down for D equals negative 4, for example, the rank is 0. For D equals negative 7, the rank is 0. For D equals negative 23, the rank is 2, so on and so forth. Okay. In order to say anything intelligent about this problem, I also have to introduce you to a modular form. So let F of tau denote the unique weakly homomorphic modular form that has weight 3 halves and transforms nicely under gamma naught 4 and lives in the Conan plus space, whose Fourier coefficients are start this way. So Q to the negative 5 plus order of Q. I'm also going to denote by C of D the Q to the negative D coefficient of F of Q. Remember that this little d is the same little d as before. So in particular, it is negative. So I'm actually talking about positive powers of Q. Okay, so then this is the same table as before. It's still the same values of negative d and the same values of the rank, but I've now inserted a column which has values of C of D in it. And you might notice that I've colored some of them red. And I'm gonna pause here and ask if you can guess what's common between the red numbers that's not true of the black numbers. So feel free to either put in the chat or unmute yourself or to tell me if you can guess what's common between the red numbers. This is a short talk, so you have to guess quickly. Okay, there's something in the chat. Let me read that. Rank 0, great. Okay, very good. Hi, Libby. okay, so the rank, so that is a great observation. So whenever these numbers are red, the rank is 0. Here's another observation. If you divide these numbers by 19, which clearly you could have guessed, right? Then you would get, it becomes more clear that the numbers that are red are ones that are not divisible by 19. So these are the ones that leave a remainder when I divide them by 19. And so the theorem that I'm gonna state on the next slide is gonna say this always happens. Whenever C of D is not 0 mod 19, you get that the rank is 0. So you can basically detect ranks of these elliptic curves, information about ranks of these elliptic curves by just looking at the coefficients of this modular form and dividing them by 19. So here's the actual theorem. Let TH denote the Thompson's group, which is a sporadic simple group of this order. Then the theorem says there is an infinite dimensional graded Thompson module W, such that if the dimension of WD is not 0 mod 19, then the Mordovier group is finite. So in particular, the rank is 0 for each elliptic curve of conductor 19 and each D as above. So basically, it's a mouthful, but I'm gonna break it down a little bit. The theorem is saying two things. It's saying that for the Thompson group, there is some infinite dimensional graded module such that its graded dimension is just the F of tau from before. So these dimensional WDs are actually the C of Ds from before. And then the second part of the theorem is saying that whenever these C of Ds are not 0, you can detect information about the ranks of these elliptic curves, associated elliptic curves. Okay, so in my last couple of minutes, I'm gonna summarize what I've just done. I have told you a story where I've said, hey, here's a hard problem. Computing ranks of elliptic curves is hard. Here's a theorem. If you can just compute these coefficients of these modular forms and divide them by 19, then you never have to look at you can get information about the ranks without actually computing the ranks. And now I'm gonna say that if computing the coefficients of the modular form was also hard, then I've done nothing for you. I've just taken a hard problem and converted it into another hard problem. But I want to convince you that that is not true. Actually, computing each of these coefficients of the modular form is not hard. If the words traces of singular moduli mean anything to you, then these coefficients are just traces of singular moduli. If they don't mean anything to you, then these coefficients can be computed by just taking a finite sum over, a finite set over values of the J function. So they're actually, it is a finite computation. You can just do it easily. So actually the theorem is converting a hard problem into a possibly easier problem. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this nice talk. Are there any questions? I see Anne and Theo. So Anne, would you like to go first?
Yes, very nice, except that it went very fast.
Sorry.
Yeah, so this 19, where's the 19 coming from? I missed it.
Yeah, great. So the elliptic curve I started with. this elliptic curve is actually an elliptic curve of conductor 19. So that's also part of, so it is an elliptic curve of conductor 19. And I picked 19 as, you know, I wanted to give a concrete example in this talk. A similar theorem is true for 14. The important part is that you have some information about the elliptic curves of that conductor, and that number has to divide the order of the Thompson group in order for this. So there's two different things going on that dictate 19. But okay. Yeah, you can write a similar theorem for 14, for example.
Okay, and this is really specific to the monster group. I mean, because you have the J function there. So there is nothing for Mathieu Moonshine type of things that you've...
Okay, so this theorem is basically giving you an example of Moonshine for the Thompson group. The functions that appear here are weight three half weakly homomorphic modular forms. So the J of tau is not actually one of these functions. And there are examples in the literature, at least the one that I know of is Unen Moonshine, which does a similar thing for the Unen group. The integral part in proving this is that these are weight three halves functions. I have faith that other examples of this exist, but I don't know them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, Theo, go ahead with your question.
I was hoping to ask sort of the same question as Anne, but what I wanted to know was, where did Thompson's group come from? What is this special specifically? Like, Thompson's group is one of many sporadic groups even. How much input are you using from Thompson?
Yeah, so great. That's also a great question. So again, this is like the paper that this is based on, which I can put in the chat, like an archive link to that. Basically, the first main half of that paper is that Moonshine for the Thompson group that involves weight three halves modular forms exists. So I was already working on Moonshine with the Thompson group, and this is like application of that Moonshine also exists, right? This part is like applying the thing that I've proven about Thompson group to this. Are there other examples of Moonshine for weight three halves functions where the group is not Thompson group or Onan group? You know, I don't know. I want to say that, like, that's basically the question of, like, if I give you a function, what groups would have Moonshine for those functions? And that's kind of a big question in the theory. I feel like in my head, that's a very deep question. I don't know the answer.
When you're, if the chair doesn't mind, when you're constructing the Moonshines, are you, sometimes I think about a group like Thompson's group sort of from the bottom up, from say its character table or from its Seeloff subgroups, from its Seeloff subgroups or something. And sometimes I think about it sort of from outside, where, like, I know Thompson is sort of closely related to E8 and to the monster. Like, should I think of the Moonshine as coming from its like E8 and or monstrous versions, or should I think of it as like something about it, some its internal structure on its own?
That's a very good question. So my answer is, I'm thinking about it in the first manner. So I'm like just looking at the character table and being like, oh, these numbers look like they might be related, and, you know, like very intrinsically on the Thompson group. I don't think that means that you should only think about it in the first. I think the direction to go from here is to also figure out how the Thompson group is related to other things, and if we can relate elliptic curves to those things. So yes, so a priori I'm thinking about it in the first way, but the second way is also in my brain as something that I want to explore.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I think we should finish. Libby, do you still have a question? I saw that you're raising your hand.
Oh yeah, I think Anne asked my questions.
Oh, okay, good. So all the questions were asked, answered. Okay, so we have one more speaker today, but I don't see her on the list.